Okay, the title is Politics of Homosexuality and Same-Sex Marriage, a Historical Perspective. Oh, another thing. This is Hong Kong. And you look so familiar to people I deal with, but you're not from the United States. So this is based on what has been going on in the state. So I know that at some point in time, it's not going to fit. But there's one universal culture. It's urban culture. Wherever you go, the same culture. So I don't think it's going to be completely like missing the target. But that much that you need to know so that you'll have to kind of fill in the blanks if I'm not doing that. So when I say politics, I'm not talking about voting. You know, that's not what I'm talking about. But politics as in agenda-driven data analysis so that people are actually getting a very skewed perspective. And when you're there long enough, then that becomes the truth. That's what I mean by politics. And when I say historical perspective is that, yeah, it is historical perspective because what we are actually dealing with, like same-sex marriage, is a result of what has been taking place since the 90s, actually. I've been keeping tab on this since then. My PhD was in postmodernism, so this issue somehow was one of the areas that I looked into to see the editorial changes in major magazines and newspapers. So I collect a lot of data. So I've been keeping... So it's going to be like that. It's going to be like So that's why it has to be historical perspective, how we got here today. So that's why I named it historical perspective. And so there are four distinct parts, you know, of course, introduction. And then I'm going to introduce this concept. Maybe you're familiar with it, the word discourse. But don't worry, I'll explain what it is. What is the homosexual discourse? And then whatever it is, third is deconstructing the homosexual discourse. And then fourth, theological importance of the institution of marriage and all the things that entail from that concept. You know, obviously that part is very important, but I had to do that at the end. Okay, so introduction. You know, I don't want to insult you, but I think too many Christians are like this guy. He doesn't think. But his heart is very enlarged. You know, heart is good, but when it's enlarged, it's not very good. And so we stop thinking coherently as Christians, especially with this issue. A good example beside this issue is in the church, only Jesus saved. And then if somebody from Time Magazine interviews you, do you think other faiths also offer salvation? And we go, yes. What is that? That's incoherent thinking, you know. And we do that all the time. Evangelical, they say only Jesus only, and then 60-70%, all the research, yes, if they're good Muslim and good Buddhist, they go to heaven. I mean, so that is very, it's like this. So an example in the area that I'm talking about is, I've heard this many times, and it really bothers me. I believe homosexuality is a sin. But I'm for gay marriage. You see, to me, that is incoherent logic. As logical as saying marry bachelor. I mean, you can say it. Skinny fat, you know. I mean, you know, roundish square. I mean, with words, we can say anything, right? But see, that's very incoherent. Let me give you two coherent sentences. One, coherent logic would be because I believe homosexuality isn't a sin, I'm for gay marriage. That makes perfect sense to me. I might agree with it, but yeah, that makes sense. You don't think it's morally indefensible, you think it's morally defensible, so you are for gay marriage. Yeah, that makes sense. You're very coherent. I disagree, but at least I understand your logic. Or, because I believe homosexual is a sin, I'm against gay marriage. Yeah, that makes sense too, and those oppose this, at least you say that, yeah, you know, you're not right in the fence. I understand. I disagree. Yes. But while I believe homosexuality is a sin, I'm for gay marriage, that shows me that that Christian is affected more by the homosexual discourse than God's word. So let me just lay out what my goals are. The two goals, you know, goals are kind of broad-ended. Oops. Oh, what did I do? Did I do something? First is, I hate it when technology gets in the way, and it does all the time. So first is to help Bible-believing Christians to think rationally, biblically, and critically. Yeah, that's what I like to do, help you to think rationally, biblically, and critically on homosexuality and its related issues. Are we going to have the screen? It's black. I don't know why it's black. Okay. And then second goal sounds kind of weird. Second goal is, and I don't say this to be funny, but I really mean it, because in the United States, the tide has turned. In June 2015, everything changed. So I would say to them, who? The promoters of homosexuality. I want to persuade the promoters of homosexuality to better inform those who are considering it. Yeah. I think that's fair. I want you to better inform those who are thinking about it or curious about it, since now it's legal completely. Now, so what does that mean, right? See, in the U.S., the legitimation of homosexuality is here to stay. It's been like that in Europe, you know, especially Scandinavian countries and Netherlands, obviously. As I alluded, 2015 Supreme Court decision that upheld same-sex marriage solidifies its legality. Thus, for those who are, for whatever reason, find this lifestyle attractive and appealing, they should have all the facts before embracing it. Because they don't have all the facts. You see, we live in liberal democracy and free market. No one living in liberal democracy and free market should feel uneasy about the approach of let the buyer beware. That's why we have not declared alcohol and cigarette illegal substance. They are very legal substance. But the government is saying that you want to drink and you want to smoke, well, do so out of a free choice, free will, with eyes open. There are dangers. So that we can make a wise decision. Now, I think that's fair. So I'm treating it as a product or something that people are trying. We should tell them everything about this product. A contrasting reality, so I'm going to say this and then prove it. Basically, try homosexuality, it will make you happy. Thus, gay. But I say to you that inaccuracy is the norm. Disinformation is not the same as misinformation. Misinformation is your honestly communicated incorrect facts. That could be forgiven. Disinformation is intentionally misleading the public. And that's not always nice. So I'm just saying that the whole truth isn't being told. And I'm going to do that by utilizing all the available published document, mostly from secular media. Therefore, you cannot possibly, you're using Christian manipulated document. No, there's some from Christian magazines, Christian documents, and these are credible, but mostly from the kind of stuff, kind of magazine that, or periodicals and books that you can also buy. Now, oblivious to what homosexuality really entails, anywhere from insufficient rationale to legitimatize it, to typical manners in which it is actually practiced. I don't know by experience, but I read enough. And tell you the truth, it was very difficult to read about it, but I did read it. So I know how it is practiced, the way it is typically practiced. Anywhere from health risk of gay sex, disease, and longevity of life. These are all there in CDC, Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia. It's not in some pastor's book. These are all official statistics. To the effect of same-sex marriage on the institution of marriage itself, many now support it while others try it out because of its attractive packaging. We're basically buying the book based on its cover. It's a very attractive package, especially when beautiful people come out and kiss one another before receiving their MTV Music Award. It's very attractive. When good-looking people, now, in the olden days, they were stereotype, you know. But now, wow, they are gays? They're so stunningly attractive. So obviously, especially impressionable young people are more so than others curious. Now I'm going to make an assumption. So are the buyers satisfied? What the level of their satisfaction is contingent upon. I say to you, the accuracy of the product information made available to the would-be buyer, in other words, the seller claims and makes promises to sell so they can buy. Now, if it is truthful and accurate, then the level of satisfaction tends to be high because you were told that it's going to do this and you tried and it actually does what it was promised to do. So you're happy. But if the product seller and his pitch was fraught with misinformation and inaccuracy, then I would say the satisfactory level would be quite low. So far, I don't see how anybody can disagree with the logic of what I'm saying. My contention, since the promoters of homosexuality have not been truthful and accurate in informing the public about their product, it stands to reason that many who have consumed it, that is, those who have already acted upon their urge or curiosity, are not quite satisfied in the long run. Because obviously, the stuff that, I mean, sex, right? There's why people do it all the time. Well, there's an immediate gratification. So if I just say not quite satisfied, somebody who may have one just now, oh, it was very satisfying. So in the long run, you know, relationship is more than just one night sex. So in the long run, it's not going to pay off. Because of this logic, the truth has not been told. Okay, objective. These are like like specific goal that I have. To fully grasp the manner in which the gay rights advocates have constructed the homosexual discourse, I explained what it is, which is now firmly entrenched in American public life. Without this understanding, a rational discussion on homosexuality is not attainable. Thus, we engage in name-calling, hater, homophobic. You immoral sodomite! Well, there you go. That's how you end a good conversation, name-calling and labeling. And we do that all the time. They do it, and we do it too. Second, to demonstrate the duplicity of the four main pillars of a homosexual discourse. Four, what are they? Scientific pillar. Two, exegetical pillar. I hope that guy who didn't know what exegetical better be here because I'm teaching it. You know, exegetical means, oh, he's here. Oh, I like that. I like that. That's very honest. That's good. It was funny, too. It was very funny. So exegesis meaning, you know, explaining the text, getting the meaning out from the text in the biblical Bible. And then civil rights pillar. And then finally, the wholesome image pillar. So these four pillars make up the edifice of the homosexual discourse. And I'm saying to you, without understanding this, the truth encounter, because in anything, whether you want to lead somebody to Christ or you're talking about homosexuality or anything, there's truth encounter, there is power encounter, and there's a love encounter in order for us to really transform. You know, truth encounter is not, I mean, it is necessary, but not sufficient. But without truth, then power encounter and love encounter will have its effect greatly damaged. So I'm saying that this is a truth encounter. Let's know what the truth is about the issue regarding these four pillars. Okay, third objective is to present actual recommendations for a better Christian witness in the midst of dealing with homosexuality is one. And then for an alternative to same-sex marriage. And finally, to help those gays who want to leave their lifestyle. You know what? I was just sitting there, and you know, as Pastor Sam was talking, I would like nothing better than some people here to be galvanized and maybe establish a little committee or some group start praying for homosexual friend, neighbors, and then concretely reach out to them based on what I'm presenting and some of the things you may be able to attain. And this church actually are a church that where gay people can, people who are living a gay lifestyle can actually come and know that they are accepted as human beings. And if there's any agreement, any discussion on homosexuality, any disagreement will be communicated with truth and love. I didn't say just accept. We accept, but, you know, truth matters. But how you adjudicate that, and that's when. So hopefully, because, you know, it is because we are ignorant on issues, not only this, that we become fearful, so we become, we rant. Yeah. But I think more we know about this, I think there's understanding. You know, it's like this. I understand why Hillary Clinton and all the Democrats don't want to call these guys radical Muslim. They are radical Muslim. You know, the different issue. Because I travel the Islamic world myself, and I see a lot of peace-loving Muslims. So, you know, I don't mind saying those are radicalized Muslims, but I know a lot of Muslims are not like that. So, again, knowing the truth is important so that we could tell the truth in love without getting all... All right. So, discourse, what is it? I'm going to do this with an illustration that is kind of funny, hopefully. I made this story up. It's about Mary and Tom. Tom is jerk, you see, but Tom likes Mary, the co-workers. So, have you met a guy like this? You want me, right? You love me, right? You like me, right? Sam. Right. I mean, supremely confident. So, anyway. So, but, you know, Mary, nah, not really, you know, I don't really like it that much, you know. Now, I'm going to give you a list of 10 words. Dislike, not love, one, I know, you, desire, like, hate, yes, do. Okay, well, that was 12 words. Okay, so, the question is, in this particular universe, there are only these 12 words. No other words exist. So given only these words, can she express her true feeling to Tom? Yeah, sure. I dislike you. Or I do not want you. Right? So given the structure, I mean, that's a structure. You cannot take it out or add. That's what you're given. She can surely do it. Now I'm going to introduce a third person. Tom's mom. Tom's mom owns this company, and she is jerkish as well. So she shows up. This is Tom's mom and her boss, and she is ticked off that this woman is rejecting her son. So she said, you know what? I'm not going to tell you what to do. But you cannot use the word that I crossed out, or else I'll fire you. So, you can do whatever you want. I'm not forcing you. But you cannot use dislike, not hate. Those are not off. Use those words, you're fired. Now, a question that I'm going to ask you is, given this set of words, can she express her dislike for Tom? No, she can't. In other words, the structure already determined what she's able to say and express. She cannot say that. The structure has predetermined what she can say about this matter. So discourse is defined like this. A structure that is created by a network of power that determines what can be said and thought at any given moment. I got this definition from Luis Marcos, a professor in this field in Houston. A structure that is created by a network power. So, using the story that I just created, let's place who belongs to which part. So, structure is obviously a word list exclusive of negative clause. So, that's structure. Two, power. Well, power, obviously, in this case, would be her boss and Tom's mother, because she is responsible for that structure. And then the thought and words that Mary are limited, you know, she can say, only she can say is that I like and love Tom, contrary to her true feeling. Now, this is the part that I cut out. There are four main pillars. One is this. In homosexual discourse, the boundary has been set already, and you cannot disagree with it. Otherwise, there's hell to pay. First, you cannot say it is not a choice. If you say it, then you are homophobic, you are hating, you are narrow-minded, bigot. Words do matter, and you cannot say, you know, it's a choice. Two, you cannot say the Bible condemns it or Bible doesn't accept it. If you do it, then you are a narrow-minded bigot. Same thing as maybe those narrow-minded fundamentalists. Third, you have to say and believe that gays are an oppressed minority. If you say they're not, then you're a hater, you are intolerant. And four, you better say that it is wholesome. If you deviate from any... Now, it took time for this to be part of our structure. It did not happen overnight. And it was due to the work of network of power. And I'm not talking about Mary's motherland right now, right? That's the story I made up. But it's been set. It's been going on for a while. And everybody is expressing the sentiment, including people in the church. Now, I don't have any control over people outside the church. But when I start hearing these from people in the church, they're not influenced by God's word, but they're influenced by homosexual discourse, thinking that there is God because the only thing they think about is love. It's not love. Well, that part I cut out so you can get it about it. That discontinued. So anyway, this homosexual discourse was established in the 1990s, and no one dares to question the four pillars of the homosexual discourse, because the moment you do, you will be labeled as a hater and you will greatly bear some kind of social consequences. Anywhere from just being name-called, which makes you feel bad for the day, to maybe ostracized for being not with the time. So this is what I need to do first before I go to other things. So, who is the network of power that has established the homosexual discourse? Like Mary's, Tom's mother. Now, homosexual discourse, a structure that is created by a network of power that has determined what can be said and thought about homosexuality at any given moment. That is the homosexual discourse. So it's already been said, you can only think like this. You can only say like that. If you say or think differently, then all those labels that I just mentioned are replaced on you. And, you know, we're secure, but we're not that secure. If everybody is going that way and you're the only one left, you kind of want to go that way. Oh, so many studies on human psychology have indicated that clearly think that's wrong, but everybody was told, you know, when I say this is long or short, this is actually short, but is it long? Everybody raise their hand. The guy who wasn't told anything, what? That is... Then finally he raised his hand too. I mean, you know, most people are like that, and what can you tell, you know? Okay, so best way to respond to the question of who is the network of power that has established the homosexual discourse is examining how the advocates of gay rights movement managed to convert their cause as a matter of civil right. Now, this is kind of America-specific issue. You know, African-American, black people, you know, they were able to galvanize their cause behind this this statement, this declaration that we are a minority to whom bestowed these rights, but the government, American society, have not recognized them, therefore we've been deprived. Voting, housing, education, and employment. And eventually their cause was very successful. So today we have African American president in the United States. Unthinkable in the 1960s, but it has happened. So, deconstructing the homosexual discourse. Now we are on the third part. So, gays are an oppressed minority. I'm going to deal with that first, and then afterward. So, if I'm able to knock down all those four legs, what will happen to the roof? It should crash. That's why that illustration is the way it is. I'm going to deal with the leg. Number one, gays are an oppressed minority. Is sexual orientation or preference same as race? See, sexual orientation to me means you're born that way. Preference means that you chose. But before we get ahead of ourselves, but is this same as race? Now, what do I mean by that is, Colin Powell, he was the first African-American Secretary of the State. But before that, he was Joint Chief of Staff, military man. He's African-American. So in 1993 or 4, as a Joint Chief of Staff, at the time, military had this rule. Don't ask and don't tell. In other words, if you're homosexual, you know, just don't say anything, you know. Then we don't know, then everything's fine. That was the policy. Okay. Not anymore. It was repealed in 2011. So at that time, Colin Powell, he said, when people on the right, left said, that's discrimination. You are discriminating against homosexuals by telling them don't ask and don't tell. He said this, you know, I need no lectures. I think race is different from sexual orientation. Now, that was then. He changed his mind, 2010. Okay? But at that time, I need no lecture. I think race is different from sexual orientation. And personally, I think that he probably was going with the time, because nothing had changed in terms of scientific research indicate anything different. But at least at that time, he said it's different, that it's not discrimination. At this point in time, I want to tell you, don't be given to fuzzy thinking here. What do you mean by that? You know, discrimination is not a bad word in and of itself. It occurs every day, and we accept it as a fact of life as long as it is based on criteria that is acceptable. Oh, that's what you say. Look, for example, when it is based on merit. Look, this company is asking for BS in chemistry, and you have a BS in music, they're not going to hire you, and that is not unjustifiable discrimination. And we accept that. Or you may be discriminated based on your behavior. What do you mean? Man, there are restaurants that would accept you if you come in there with shorts and barefoot. You're going to call that discrimination? They have the house rule. You want to come in here? Then dress properly. This is discrimination based on behavior. And we accept that. So every single discrimination isn't something that is terrible when it's based on merit or behavior. Now, race, like gender, is physiologically determined. In other words, they had no choice in the matter. You did not choose to be a girl. I just thought about Bruce Jenner, one-time hero of mine, 1970s decathlon athlete. Okay. They had no choice in the matter. Race is predetermined. Since it is inborn, no one should be discriminated based solely on that. That's why when you are solely discriminated based on your race and gender, that is not good discrimination, and those who do it should be prosecuted. And we have laws. Like this one, female accountant required. This kind of ad may be okay in Pakistan, this is from Pakistan, but not anymore in Hong Kong or in the United States. Can you imagine putting that kind of ad in United States or Hong Kong? I don't know about your culture, but not in the United States. You get a lawsuit, for sure. Why do you want female accountant? What do you got in your sleeve, you know? Now, whether gays need civil rights protection hinges on this. Is homosexuality also physiologically determined? That's the question, folks. If they're not, then they're not a recipient of any special treatment. But if they are born that way, and because of that they're being discriminated, then of course we should have laws to protect them. That's the issue, folks. We discriminate all the time based on merit and behavior. But people who are born a certain way, we don't do that. Now, I want to talk about gay rights movement. This is a short history. I'm old enough where I used to see this, the first attempt. The first attempt at trying to be accepted by the mainstream America. They knew that they had to be accepted by mainstream America. I mean, that's what has happened. This is very, very successful social movement. It happened pretty quick. For blacks, it took hundreds of years. Gay rights, it all happened in 1990. I'm going to tell you which book it was and who was responsible. But before that, they were trying to be accepted. Whilst the gays certainly saw themselves as oppressed people since their sexuality was deemed aberrant, they didn't start out thinking that their grievances were equated to the struggles of African Americans in need of civil rights protection. They didn't think that at first. Not in the 80s. They never thought it. Nobody ever said that we are minority, we need civil rights. You know, nobody said that. Not even one person, because that wasn't their strategy. The first attempt at trying to be accepted by the mainstream America was by flaunting their sexuality through gay pride marches. That was their main mechanism to do so. Did it work? It certainly did not. And now my words don't matter. I'm going to borrow the words of two scholars, Marshall Kirk and Hunter Matson, Harvard-trained psychiatrists, and they were gay themselves. So as far as this goes, they have total credentials. They're gay, they're really, really well educated, and they are professionals. And they wrote this book. It's called After the Wall: How America Will Conquer Its Fear and Hatred of Gays in the 90s. I read this book, and I learned so much. Why their attempt to be accepted failed. They said, you know, gay revolution has failed. They are not accepting us. They are recoiled at us. They are more recoiled at us than before. And it's our fault. They were blaming themselves. Now let's read the analysis of their first attempt. This was actually presented in Time magazine in 1989. So the writer of that particular article wrote like this. The authors, Kurt and Masson, put much of the blame for the revolution's failure on gays themselves. Now, I'm going to have to show you some disturbing pictures to get a feel for what was going on in gay pride marches. So here it is. You're the adults, so I'm sure it's okay. The movement for too long was wrongly focused on sexual freedom and self-expression. Drag queens and butch lesbians. I don't know whether Sam was there or not, but one time I had this video about the march, and I was showing it on Friday night in our Bible study. And while I was showing it, policemen came in. And I thought, oh my God, I thought I was going to get arrested. No, they came because somebody double parked. So I was so relieved. I remember that. I don't know, were you there? Yeah. It was explicit. It was X-rated kind of stuff. And anyway, I won't show that because I don't have it anymore. Issues that they feel have antagonized the public. It was time for new strategy. We cannot go on like this. We cannot win the acceptance doing it like this. So these two smart people change up strategy by Masson and Kurt. So Masson, for the first time, he articulated this view. The gay movement hasn't got nearly so far as the black civil rights movement. Thus, gays need to project an unflattening, respectable image to the straight world. We're going to change our style, folks. No more flamboyant access. You know, let's curb this stuff. keep the drag queens and butch lesbians out of the public eye and let us show up with neckties and suitcases. So they let them see that we are normal people like them. That we don't spend every moment thinking about sex, 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 sex. Because they said, oh, I think the straight people think the only thing that gay people think about is sex, sex, sex. That we don't want to be known as gay. We want to be known as engineers, doctors, lawyers who happen to be gays. You know, like we want to be like engineers who have to be Christian. Instead, the emphasis should be on civil rights and fairness, concerns that appeal to all Americans. That's when they repackage this movement. And I want you to know that, not that I'm so smart, but the churches were not picking this up. And there was one event, a decisive moment in American history in which the transformation of gay image took place. And they follow to the T the plan that the black people had established to win the public's approval. At least it was the beginning point. March in Washington. I don't know if you saw the march in Washington by African Americans in 1965 or 66, and that drew 200,000 people, where Martin Luther King gave that great speech, I Have a Dream speech. The one that my children will be known by the character, not by concept of the character, more so than the color of their skin. He was that speech. Well, they followed that plan. This was the gay march on Washington, D.C. in 1993. Now, I want you to look at the kind of pictures that accompanied many, many articles about this event in magazines and newspapers at that time. You go, you see, newspapers and magazines? Yeah, we got our news from news magazines and newspapers in the 90s. Not from this. Print media was, you know, what we got the news. Now, look at the pictures. Oh, very nice family. Oh, wonderful folks having a night, day out, Washington Monument. Those are the pictures that accompanied all the articles that were written about this 1993 march. Newspapers said 1 million people came. That's five times more than the African Americans who showed up for their march. You know, that's a significant number. I mean, if they march there, I'm sure they'll draw more than that. 1 million. I was shocked. They drew 1 million? You know, I was subscribing to a lot of magazines at the time. Editorial, you know, pop culture magazines, opinion magazines. And then I subscribed even one or two from Great Britain. This magazine doesn't print anymore, I don't think. The Economist from Great Britain. And it was 1993, and I opened this magazine, and they don't always deal with economic issues, although that's what they do. And I saw this page, and I was stunned. Now, this is not a Christian magazine, folks. This is well-respected magazine, periodical dedicated to world economy by the Brits. You know, Brits have no desire to, you know, hide anything for the sake of Americans. They're very honest, you know. And that was the difference. What the American media refused to report. There's going to be one very disturbing scene. I need you to see that. And then I'm going to hide it real quick. Ready? The title of this particular article is Cover Up Uncovered. Cover Up Uncovered, Washington, D.C. I'm going to read this with you. Revisionists already at work on April 24th, gay march on Washington. At that time, the television network served up images of Gap-wearing middle managers having a day out. Those who went down to the mall to look also. Notice their breasted lesbians, some would ring through their nipples. Men in their leather trousers studded harnesses and t-shirts proclaiming every 10th Jesus is a queer. What they're saying is that 10% of the population is gay. That's the number they throw around. Some of the speeches were less than soothing too. I did not read any of these things in American publications. Unless had I gone there, I would not have known unless I read this magazine that came from Great Britain. Whatever happened to those unsettling scenes? The network did not report them, nor did the press. They did not report. It's like this guy. It is a family atmosphere, folks. These clean folks here are out there to march for a great cause. I see nothing. I hear nothing. This is the media talking. Journalists tend to march with the gays in spirit, believing that they had a cause, a case, and an important constituency as they are for the Democratic Party. What happened to objectivity in journalism? I guess when the cause is right, it goes out the window, and then you write about this. And counting heads, you know, they said 1 million, right? Still an impressive number. It was actually 300,000. That's still a good number, but that's less than one-third of what they reported. But they used 1 million number because that's what the organizer said. Yeah, it's 1 million. Never mind what the park police had said. You know, they measure by the photo, satellite photo. Never mind what park police said. If the organizer said 1 million, then it's 1 million. 1 million sounds really impressive. And then an economist said this. You know, it was not for lack of space. Most newspapers devoted pages to the subject, but they did not want to offend the public. And most important, they had billed the march as a civil rights story. They had billed the march as a civil rights story, as if it is same as the black civil rights. Yep. The vision of Kurt and Masson in 3 years, done deal. It happened fast. After that, the vocabulary changed. Civil rights. And when you violate civil rights, that's not good. It brings the image of what the Caucasian people did to black people. And, oh, we don't want to do that again. And everything changed. Got a lot of help from whom? Well, I asked you before, homosexual discourse, a network of power. Who is this network power? The mainstream media that seeks to shape your worldview. Either you let them shape your worldview, or you come to the house of God and let God's word shape your worldview. I'm not saying that you cannot get anything from this. But if you are solely looking at the news right now, you wouldn't know that more people were murdered in Kenya yesterday by the similar type of idiots, wicked people. Because all we care about is what happened in France. Because they prioritize, and we basically go along what they do, unless we are curious enough to look into other news and then form our new opinion. Don't naively believe everything they say. It's not too late. The percentage of gay population, let me just go through that one more time. You know, look at this. The survey of identical twins links biological factors with being gay. LA Times, still a very viable newspaper, even more so in the 90s. The incidence of homosexuality in the population at large is estimated at, according to LA Times, 4 to 11%. 11 is a lot. But in 1993, I used to use a lot of noise, and they're still there, and it's good that, you know, comes out every now and then. They don't do this kind of research anymore, but let me tell you something. 10% is a lie. That 10% came from a study called Kinsey study in 1950s. Was amazingly skewed database. 10%. Allen Gottman Institute is a liberal think tank. They're not right wing. Chicago University is, you know, that's one of the top universities. Same year, they both want to know this. the shrinking 10% came out, this article, because they found out, they both found out that the percentage of men who actually engage in homosexual act at least once, 2%. And the percentage of men who said they were homosexuals, 1%. I know the numbers probably have gone up. I think more people are trying now. It should make sense. You know, the national survey claiming that only 1% of men are gay has put the movement off stride. I would think so. But, you know, initially they were like punched. Oh, but then after a while, forget 1%. 10% again. Go read. It's always 10% again. That's how the game is played. You know, you hear it and then, you know, you forget it. And then, oh yeah, they forgot it. So 10%. And that's the structure. Not everyone neither agreed nor appreciated what the gay rights advocate did with black civil rights. Oh, the Christians. No, they, unfortunately, Christians didn't know what the, I shouldn't use that word. What's going on? I didn't say it. I almost said it, but they sat out. Looking back, because there were two groups of people who were not happy with this. And you know what? The answer may shock you. Who were not happy that the gay rights advocates, you know, took on this black civil rights upon themselves. Now, here, have you ever wondered how African Americans felt about their civil rights struggle used in this manner by gays? Right now, you know, they're numb. They don't really care. In the 90s when it came out, let me tell you, civil rights movement was actually hostile to homosexuals. I'm not saying that's good or bad. I'm just giving you fact. Of all the civil rights advocates, there were two men who were gay. Rustin and, you know, Baldwin, you know, great American writer, you know, Next Time Fire, that book. They were heavily involved, but initially they were involved, but they were asked to leave. So they got rid of the two gays that were involved. It was not friendly gays at all. Again, I'm not saying with glee, just a fact, folks. Reverend Ricky Porter, African-American pastor, former acting dean of Black Student Affairs for the Claremont Colleges, very good school, he said this, which was said by many other black leaders, if Martin Luther King were alive, what could he possibly think about the equating of the gay rights activism of today with the historic struggles for civil rights that he and his contemporaries so valiantly championed? Oh my goodness. They weren't happy with this. Do you think they were, bravo, bravo, because they said, we were born this way. We've been discriminated based on things that we cannot change. But you, it's your preference. And you want the same right as we do? And what was the right that they wanted? Voting rights, housing rights, employment, equal employment rights, and education rights. The things, as I will prove to you later on with numbers, gay people had plenty of. But wait. Now, so African Americans being indignant, that's not a surprise, right? Now, the people I'm going to mention, there weren't that many, but there were a few of these guys. They weren't very happy with this either. You know who they were? These were actually some gay intellectuals who didn't think that gays qualify as an opposed minority. Andrew Sullivan, he's a Harvard-educated, Harvard-Oxford guy. He's a Brit. I mean, you guys went to Harvard and Harvard or Oxford? I mean, he's your alum. He's part of your alum. Smart man. He used to be an editor for New Republic. And he's a blogger, still around. 1993, he wrote this. He said, unlike blacks 3 decades ago, gay men and lesbians suffer no discernible communal economic deprivation. And already, we operate at the highest levels of society in boardroom, government, the media, the law. They may have advanced so far, the gays, because they have not disclosed their sexuality. But their sexuality as such has not been an immediate cause for their disadvantage. It never actually works against them. Now, see, if I said it, ah, you bigot, you hater. I'm just quoting him and I agree with him. So you call me bigot, then call him a bigot. I don't think you will. He's a big deal. Now, his views probably have changed. I know it's changed on some other issues, but that's what they said in the 90s. You know, for a reason. The numbers I'm going to give to you are numbers of the 90s. But the pattern, same. Two things. Household income and education level. This comes from Overlook Opinion, Chicago Market Research Company, with a database of 35,000 gay men and lesbians. I'm sure they do the same thing every other year. Income. At that time, homosexuals, their annual income was over $51,000. Second group, lesbians, over $42,000. The rest of us, $36,000. How are they discriminated? You know, Blacks for Rights was about this. They were even below the national level. So they had a case. Education. Okay? Well, population as a whole, 12.7 years. And I don't think this number has changed that much. I mean, you know. So what's 12? Is that 6, 3? So, a little above high school. Well, that's all right. But homosexuals, 15.7 years, they have a college degree. They're better educated. No wonder a lot of successful people that we see out there in music and art, they get better education. So how are they discriminated? Before you say, well, they still are, let me introduce another guy, Jonathan Rauch. He's still around. He's a writer. He's also not as big deal as Sullivan. But 93, he wrote a stunning article. He said this. The oppression diagnosis, for the most part, is wrong. Life is not terrible for most gay people, and it is becoming less terrible every year. Because there are five criteria by which you determine whether a group is actually really in need of some kind of governmental redress so that they could, you know, be on equal footing. He said, because only one factor out of five for what constitutes a discriminated group applies to gays. Government discrimination, denial of political franchise, denial of education, relative impoverishment, human rights violation without recourse. Of those five criteria, only one. Government discrimination that they cannot get married. That's the only one. All the other four criteria, we do very well. So being honest, you know, humanist, well, you know, I can't really claim that title on us when he sympathetic toward blacks. Like, we're robbing them, you know, like, we have so much, and we want to take their status as an oppressed minority and so that we could just, you know, get married like this. Well, but see, that's one thing that the African Americans weren't deprived of. In other words, they never lost the right to get married. Civil rights did not include the right to get married. They always were able to get married. That was never part of the civil rights package. Thus, the following statement made by a University of Pennsylvania student, I got it from a newspaper of UPenn, would be historically inaccurate. And this is what actually most people believe. She said this, it is ridiculous that people would deny the right to marriage. It's almost like going back to the civil rights movement. And I go, you go back to the rights movement, that would not be even talked about, girl. But see, you know, I'm just giving you straight out, you know. This is not a civil rights issue, as we understood what it was for black people. They could still say, we want to get married, but they have to figure out some other label, not civil rights. It was never part of black civil rights. Oh, by the way, that they cannot get married? That's not true. They already have the right to get married. They want an additional right. I mean, they can get married. Who said they cannot get married? They can get married, but they want an additional right. Marry somebody of the same sex. I think I did this. Gays are an oppressed minority. I think I constructed it. So that pillar doesn't stand. What do you think? If facts matters, if truth matters, I think I give a plausible scenario that this was fancied, imagined, but now it's a fact. That's not all I can do about it, but at least I can talk to you and so that you can think clearly on this issue. Second one is, it's not a choice. Oh, this is the killer one, is it not? You know, I've never seen this show, but because of this particular woman, I researched it, so I know something about this show called The Sex and the City. Her name is Carrie, right? So she was pretty good, and then like third year, she came kind of bad. You know, I don't know. Anyway. So not about her, not about her. It's about this woman, Cynthia Nixon. I never seen her in any movie, but she came out. For me, being gay was a conscious choice. And I go, yeah, I agree with you. But, you know, she said it, right? Oh, my goodness. All hell broke loose. Not by Christians, but the gay rights advocates. They did not like that. So, this gay rights advocate, a guy named Beeson, he commented and came out in a newspaper, a magazine. You know, Cynthia did not put adequate thought into the ramification of her word. What is she talking about? When people say it's a choice, they are greenlighting an enormous amount of abuse because, you know, if it's a choice, then people will try to influence and guide young people to what they perceive as the right choice. You see, you can't say that word. You cannot say that word. If you are a gay rights advocate and you are in the gay community, choice. When it comes to abortion, that's the magic word, is it not? But when it comes to this, you cannot use that word. Even a lesbian herself used it. She was excoriated for using this word for giving aid and comfort to the enemy. Like me. I guess. Okay. Argument based on science that allegedly support the homosexual discourse. Study. Sexual preference has biological link. What causes people to be homosexual? A study pinpoints a difference in the brain. Not theological study, not sociological study, but scientific study. Now, is there any scientific study that firmly links homosexuality to a determinative physiological factor? Because it seems like there must be at least one or two or three because people believe that people are born this way. Now, vocabularies are very important and categories. If you forget most of what I'm going to teach, remember this. There are two distinct factors when it comes to human behavior. Determinative factor and predispositional factor. Determinative factors are those that will generate basic sexual orientation regardless of the environment in which the individual grew up. It's a biological Calvinism. You are predestined to be gay because you are made that way. It doesn't matter whether you are a dominating mother, passive mother, or perfect mother, you'll be gay because that's how. But predispositional factors are inborn tendencies that could make it easier for a person to fall into certain behavior like drinking, but it's not guaranteed. Environment has a lot to do with it. These innate traits are not genetics, folks. Caused by influence from various aspects of the environment in the womb. And as you notice, I'm footnoting Santanova. MIT Harvard trained psychiatrist. So I'm in good company quoting him. So these are not genetics. For instance, hormones, infections, exercise, general health, the ingestion of illicit or licit drug, and many other variables influence this environment. In the 1950s or 60s, you took this particular drug and they were born in a Dolphin syndrome without arms because this drug actually had a side effect that resulted in birth defect. It happened in the womb. It wasn't genetics. Now, I don't know. I guess you're pregnant. I guess before long, you might be doing this. What could that be? You'll do this. Da, la, 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 la. And you may hate classical music, but for your sake of your child, please listen. But no pregnant mom would listen to classical music for her baby's sake, believing that it will alter baby's genetic makeup. It's already predetermined, or whatever it is in there, but you are trying to influence her innate traits. These are called predispositional factors. Meaning what? Meaning certain environmental, experiential, and cultural conditions can make it easier for a person to fall into certain behavior, such as violence, excessive drinking, and sexual preference. Yes, some people are born with predispositional inclination to homosexuality. If you deny that, then they will probably say, oh, go back to your cave. Nobody's denying that. Some people are born with more predisposition toward drinking, thus fetal alcoholic syndrome. However, these innate factors alone do not determine those behaviors. And that's what you need to know. And nicely, kindly, gently, next time somebody says something, you explain to them. I certainly believe there are factors called predisposition factors that would make it easier for a person to be homosexual, but ultimately environment is the one who will make it go or not. Now, about the studies. You know, I remember still the very first study that was done. Oh, it was big news. Remember 1991? Everybody talked about this study. It was the first time it was done. And again, we used to watch TV news, nightly news, and it came out. It was done by Harvard neuroscientist, a guy named Simon LeVay. No dummy. Very smart man. He's a gay, and his lover died of AIDS. And he was so forlorn, and so he decided to do this research to tell the world that, you know, he's not some pervert, you know. He was born that way. So he was driven by his personal passion. That's okay, as long as it doesn't affect his methodology. You know, passion is good, but in research, perhaps not. Because, well, I mean, you know, I think passion is good, even research, but you shouldn't have to follow scientific method, right? Did he do that? Well, let me see. What he did, 1991, so some of you guys weren't even born. Mom, I'm old. So what he did was, he analyzed the size of hypothalamus, which regulates male sexual behavior, of 41 brains, meaning these are dead people and you couldn't ask them, you know, what's up. 19 men who died of AIDS, 16 heterosexuals, and 6 women. I hope that he knew for sure that 19 were gay who died of AIDS and 6 heterosexuals. Because once the brain been donated, if the marking wasn't very good, you might be examining heterosexual brain, thinking it's homosexual brain. Now, I'm not just saying that because that is going to be a factor, folks, which the media did not report. Because they only have 2 minutes to summarize all this. Do you think they're going to talk about methodology in TV news? What he found? He found the gold. He said one bundle of neutrons in the hypothalamus was nearly 3 times as large in heterosexual men as in gay men. So this particular hypothalamus that controls male sexual behavior, gay people, it was like 1/3 smaller. Structural change or difference? His conclusion? well, let the media do it for him. Gay men born that way. A new study suggests that there is a structural difference between the brains of homosexual and heterosexual men. That was the beginning of so-called scientific basis for saying that it's not a choice, but they were born that way. Was this inconclusive? No, due to multiple problems of his study. I hope that Chauncey Phillip never sued me for using his image to advocate cause that he may not agree with. I thought about that the other day. Maybe I'll change, you know. You never know, right? Now, you know what? It turned out that it was uncertain whether all the heterosexual men in the study were heterosexuals. He couldn't ask because they were dead. Funny, but tragically so. Hey, I've done two major research for my studies. And, you know, blind data is very important. You got to make sure that you are not skewing the data by collecting it from sources that you don't know where they're coming from. He actually didn't know. Not all of them, some of them, but it matters. He only had 41. Furthermore, since AIDS virus attacked the brain, the size difference could be an artifact of the disease. In other words, it failed to establish cause and effect relationship. Then what's that? Of course, media didn't report this. Scores of studies have found that neurons changes in response to experience. Thus, it's possible that the difference actually has nothing to do with sex orientation, or that it is the result rather than the cause of homosexuality. The different conclusion by other researchers. So, you know, they weren't, I don't know whether it was peer review. I don't know. I don't think it was. But later on, other people like, I don't know, really, well, let me see what he did. So, Anna Fausto Sterling, at the time, was teaching at Brown University. She made the stunning statement, my freshman biology studies didn't know enough to sink this study. That's not a compliment. John Money, what a name. The real John Hopkins, the real question is, when did it get there? The small hypothalamus, was it prenatal, neonatal, during childhood, puberty? We don't know. Then what good is the study? And then Dr. Simon himself said, this sound you have to hear. Yes. What I reported was a difference in the brain structure of the hypothalamus. What we cannot say on the base, we cannot say on the base of that what makes people gay or straight. Why did you say so in the first place? He didn't. I guess not, because the media just took off. You know, inaccuracy, disinformation. I would consider that inaccuracy. And if he did it on purpose, that's disinformation. And media did not re-report this, that's also disinformation. You think if that's something, wait until the second study. Your jaw will drop. And these are smart people. Harvard, these two guys, Northwestern and Boston School of Medicine, these are two psychiatrists with high-level people. Okay, they did a twin study. This is number two study. What they did, they figured, oh, man, they study three groups, identical twins, fraternal twins, and adopted brothers. But they were all living under the same parent, same environment. Keep that in mind, okay? So, they ask, one twin, fraternal, identical, or brother, adopted, if one of the twin or brother is gay, what about the other twin and the other brother? Is he gay also? Okay, it's very simple methodology. So, if both are gays, then they call it concordant event. Two are gays. So let's see which of the three groups have the highest percentage of concordant event, meaning pairs who happen to be both gays. Now, you can kind of like, if genetic has everything to do with it, obviously, you know, identical twins have the identical genetic makeup. So they should have a higher rate. And certainly it did. what he found out, what they found out, of the 56 identical twins who shared the same genetic makeup, more than half were both gay. More than half were concordant events. Both were gays. Fraternal twins, a little over 20%. And then adopted brothers, 11%. I don't like that sound. Now, so their conclusion, well, we have to conclude, and then I'm going to let the media, you know, do the talk. Survey of identical twins links biological factors with being gay. Determinative factor. They had no choice. They were destined to be gays. LA Times further said, the second study strongly suggests a genetic component to homosexuality. Now we're heading in that direction where if you say choice, you are really uneducated. You know, they say that. You're really uneducated, aren't you? Oh, that really makes you feel bad, huh? You're ignorant about this, aren't you? You're in dark age, ain't you? Huh? Stone age? Because you don't really know. Well, let's see. Was this conclusive? No, due to multiple problems of the study. I mean, I'm trying to see, please, you know, number one, methodology, you know, database. The research subjects were solicited through advertisement in openly pro-gay magazines and tabloids. Of course, that's easy. So if I want to learn what percentage of Hong Kong citizens are Christians, let me go do a survey at Solomon's Porch. Oh my goodness, 100%? 100% of Hong Kong people are Christians. I mean, look, would you trust my conclusion if I took this kind of study and data from conservative evangelical churches? Would this change the result? Of course it would. But they took an easy way out. Okay, well, let them have it for now. Because that's nothing compared to what actually they did with the data. The flawed statistical method. The 52% included the gay twin whose brother was not gay. What do you mean? Okay, watch this. Okay, this is actually a simple concept, but, okay. Now, look at this chart. So I'm just made it up. So there were actually five pairs, right? Five pairs. Right? Because, you know, above one, below one, they're brothers. Okay? There are five pairs. So out of five pairs, how many pairs are concordant events? Both are gays. So what's the percentage? Well, you're very smart. Yeah, it's 60%, right? So, you know, three of five, what's the percentage? It's 60%. You know, when I read the study at first, that's what I thought. I mean, right? That's not what they did. This is what they did. They counted homosexuals in, okay, I'm going to use it. There are, how many homosexuals are there in this make-believe study that I'm giving it to? How many homosexuals are there? Eight, right? So what they did was they counted the three pairs homosexual not as three concord events, but as six out of eight. So it became 75% instead of 60%. They counted each gay person in gay twin pair as a concordant event. Do you see what they did? I go, what? If you do that in statistical lab, you're going to get an F. You don't do this. I mean, concordant is when both are gay, they're concordant. But then to increase the number, no, we're going to count all the gays in the study eight and then concordant the two each for six. Yeah, 75%. So, later on, yes, oh brother, yeah, I agree with you. Oh brother. Okay. Rather, it appears that the earlier bias research actually found about one-third of the identical pairs to be concordant for homosexuality and not 52%. But give them a credit, though. When they were called out, Bailey, he said, okay, sorry, I'll do another one. This time, I'm going to do it right. He went to Australia, and then he did a blind survey. He got a phone book out, and he called people cold turkey. Now, that's good. So, Bailey did that, so we give him credit. But the result was vastly different. Identical twins, 3 out of 24, 11%. Fraternal twin out of 16, 0. So Jones and Yardhouse, in reviewing his second study, follow-up research that refused earlier findings seldom received the same level of coverage. In other words, the media did not report. They reported, yes, 52%, but when it came down to 0 or 11%, nobody got a hold of this. Only in social psychology they saw it. Who subscribed to Journal of Personality and Social Psychology? Well, genetic influence on homosexual development may be dramatically less than his earlier studies projected, is the conclusion. So different conclusion by other researchers. Steven Goldberg, hey, remember, it was on the same parents, same environment. So it does not factor in the environment. It just as strongly indicates the importance of environment. And then same Professor Brown, it only confirmed the obvious that twins are apt to have the same sort of shaping influences. In order for such a study to be at all meaningful, you would have to look at twins raised apart. It's such a badly interpreted genetic. If you really want to do a study like this, you have to be You have to be like Nazi-like. You take two twins, you separate them at birth, and you track them for the next 20 years, and you find out whether one is gay or not. And if one is a really, really eccentric parent, the other one a really conservative parent, they're both gay, then, wow, genetic is really determinative. But are you going to do that? Apart from that, I don't know how you're going to do kind of research. This study intended to prove a shared genetic destiny toward homosexuality, but the discordant twin, those who were only one was homosexual, shows the opposite, actually. Same environment, one is gay, one is not. What does that mean? Bailey himself acknowledged this. There must be something in the environment to yield the discordant twins. How many went to Stanford? Well, maybe those guys didn't show up. I hope they lose next football game. Anyway, these two guys play for Stanford. You know, Jared and Jason Collins. I mean, you heard about these guys? They're 6'11". They're terrible, but they're tall, so they play for a long time. Jason Collins came out as gay. He came out as gay finally when he was even worse as a player. But then I just noticed that his brother wasn't gay. Same parents. One is gay and one is not. What does that prove? It doesn't prove genetics. It does prove that he may have predispositional factors and environment push him toward direction. Since his brother. In fact, you know what that shirt says? I'm the straight one. Yeah, I'm the straight one. He's a straight. So, you know, go through some of these. Make it into a conversational piece. Talk with smile. Don't be so nasty. And just say, you know, Jason Collins, that backup player, not very good, but his brother's straight, so what does that mean? I don't know what does that mean, you know? Is that genetics? Conclusion. Does not prove determinative physiological factor. I'm going to do this one, and then we're going to take a break. I exchanged this email with this guy, Carl. He's an adamant gay rights advocate, very knowledgeable guy. And basically, it's in the genetics, stupid, was his line, you know. It's in the genetics. And he said, you know what, Ryan, there's a great deal of research into the role of genetics now. Regardless, questions of choice increasingly seem to be answered by a number of things that we cannot control. And then he listed all these studies. Impressive. I won't even read. These are all journal articles, impressive studies on genes and all that. I haven't read these. But I don't have to read these. I told him this, and he had no comeback. I noticed that the studies you cited related to genes. I think there is a fundamental misconception about how genes affect human behavior. You know, the very first study to find so-called gay gene was a guy named Dean Hamner, National Cancer Institute, 93. He said, hey, I found it, a gene that contributes to homosexual orientation in guys. I found it. And he called it XQ28. That's the
engaging.
Oh, and he was celebrated for finding it finally. So what he said was this. He noticed that the existence of homosexual brothers and homosexuality among their uncles to their mother's side, there's a correlation. So he said, and this theory, gay gene may influence the development of homosexuality that is transmitted through the mother line. That's what he observed. Gay brothers and uncles from mother's side, gays, so there must be through the mother line they get the gay gene. So that's what he said. My response, I don't care what kind of genetic study you do, because I think people are, you know, Angelina Jolie, right? Jolina? Okay, you know. You know, she had she had the major surgery, right? Because of her family history. And because of that gene that is known to affect or cause, was it predetermined? Is it absolutely going to be the case? She took a calculated measure to not even deal with that. I thought she was very brave in doing that. In some case, she did the smart thing, maybe. But was it going to happen for sure? That's the issue about genetics. What is your understanding of how genes affect human behavior? Do you hold a Calvinistic genetics? You know, biochemical predestination, wrote this guy, Gene Kenyon. In other words, determinism. No free will. Que sera, sera. Whatever will be, will be. There's nothing you can do about it. You're predestined to be that because genes, dummy, isn't the gene. But what is often, what is often unrecognized, being born with a certain gene, not trace now, being born with a certain gene, for example, an aberrant form of a gene tied to cardiovascular disease called KIF6. That gene is known to, you know, tied to this cardiovascular disease, does not mean that the carrier is predetermined to have that disease. I would imagine likelihood is higher, but that's not equal to predetermined. Because they did a survey, 57,000 people found out that genetic status had essentially no predictive value. You just look at the genetics. Not their behavior. In fact, just looking at behavior has much chance of telling you what kind of disease you will have as opposed to just genetics. Therefore, Tom Quintimonos of Stanford University Medical School made the stunning remark, this study puts the nail in the coffin. Genes cannot predict whether you're going to have that disease or not. An absolute case. Of the belief that genetic status has predictive value. Then how are you going to bring genes into homosexuality? That's not even disease. It's a behavior. You know, I just gave them some, I don't call it disease. They used to call it, I don't call it disease. It's a behavior. In fact, when it comes to predicting whether or not one will develop a cardiovascular disease, genetic status is as effective as basing it solely on behavioral choices such as smoking, high cholesterol. I just went checkup, and my doctor said, new doctor, do you smoke? Because it bears on your health. These are facts as we know today. Genetic status alone cannot predict whether a person will become a homosexual. This is fact. Those who say it is choice is really showing that they're not up to date on where the science is today. That there are actually unenlightened. But don't say that, otherwise it gets personal and you get argument. Don't do that. Just tell them they're handsome and they talk really well. What Hamner later admitted, they always admitted later. Yeah. There was a need to identify environmental, experimental, or cultural factors that influenced the development of marriage. Why didn't you say that in the first place? So much later, after the fact. Do you think media is going to cover this? Remember they walked with others, 1993 gay march. Do you think they're going to cover this? They won't. Furthermore, A later study found out that they could not duplicate the research. They couldn't find that so-called gay gene. You have to duplicate it, you know. They couldn't. Conclusion. There is no determinative physiology that would generate basic sexual orientation, regardless of the environment in which the person grew up. Some are born with innate traits that would make it easier for them to opt for homosexuality under certain environmental conditions. I agree with Sullivan, for a few more, it is an option. We could say that in the 90s. We cannot say that anymore. Homosexual discourse. But in the church, you should be able to say that without being labeled. Oh, you are intolerant and bigot. I know in the world, but don't borrow this vocabulary from the world. Stick with scripture and some good science. And let's just talk about, let's make a right choice. Let's be in the right environment. How about that? Anyway, I'm going, that which we must not do. I'll take a break. As people trained in the tradition of free inquiry in the academia and living in liberal democracy, we must declare the thought policing enforced by the homosexual discourse is just plain old wrong. They say gays must be content with their sexuality. Gays cannot and should not seek change. I think that's wrong. Any view that disagrees with this stand is to be discarded as hateful and intolerant. What is my crime? You said you chose to be homosexual. That implies that you can't get out of it. You in jail. I mean, this is, where's free, where's free speech? What's free inquiry? Question, are you saying that there aren't any gays who would rather not be gays? If there are, aren't you willing to help them? Or are you going to say, don't say things like that. You're supposed to be happy. You are gay forever. Don't say things like that. Happy, happy. Or you say, oh yeah, okay, let me help you. Then you can. You cannot help them. If you try to help them, oh, you've been brainwashed them. Look, remember this guy? Yeah, apparently no. They won't do that. You know, Beast, remember what he said? Cynthia did not put adequate thought into the ramification of a word. When people say it's choice, they are greenlighting, you know, an enormous amount of abuse because if it's a choice, people will try to influence and guide young people to what they perceive as the right choice. So never say choice so that you will never have to get these people out of homosexuality, even if they're unhappy. God, I'm sorry, but that's so unfair. That's so inhuman. I mean, don't you think so? Okay, let me switch some words around. I'm going to use same sentence of Beeson. I'm going to switch it. Beeson did not put adequate thought into the ramification of his words. When people say it's determinative physiology, they are green lighting an enormous amount of abuse because if it is destiny, people will try to influence and guide young people to stay where they are, even if they want to get out. Why can't I say that? I'm using same logic. All right, there are some who want to stay. They love it. Fine. Are you saying everybody's like that? But with this discourse, you cannot even say you want to help. Oops, I cannot say it. Can I, you know, because you chose this path. That's not fair. That's not democracy. That's totalitarian state. Okay. So the part that I'm covering is called deconstructing the homosexual discourse. So the first pillar, you know, minority or discriminated. So that pillar is down. So I just covered, it is not a choice pillar. I would imagine that the study itself has done its job of making that less than what it's supposed to be. Fact, it is not a fact. Yesterday, I don't know whether they came, but one girl asked me, one woman, my sister, asked me about, yeah, people are now using the Bible to say that Bible at worst is silent about it, at best maybe even endorse it. Yeah, so this is our alley. This one we need to know.
Who was that, man?
No. She didn't say. She said somebody. Not from this church. Of course not. But anyway, so third pillar is Bible does not condemn it. I was thinking about changing the word. Bible does not approve it. Bible accepts it. There's no verse that says that Bible is against it. Well, so we begin to see these kind of articles, like in 1990 again. Bible doesn't say what we thought it did. New biblical discoveries move toward acceptance of gay. The law should do the same. So they start getting into exegetical arena. The verses that we thought were against homosexuality is not, by going way of Greek words. So that there are actually three Greek words in contention. Two are found in 1 Corinthians 6:9, and they're on the screen. Bible doesn't say what we thought it did. Okay, let's read this passage. Do you not know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived. Neither fornicators, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor effeminate, nor homosexuals will inherit the kingdom of God. So the two words. Malakoi, which is a plural of, you know, malakos, and then alphinekoitai, those two words are the words that are being discussed, or have been discussed. So John Boswell was a Yale historian, brilliant, died of AIDS in 1994, and he actually, you know, made this article. There's no good reason to believe that the two Greek words of the original text connoted homosexuality. You know what they're getting at right now, right? That's wrongly translated. So, according to Boswell, with his credential, malakoi, effeminate in NASB, means sexually loose, like that boy, and therefore is not a technical term for homosexuality, homosexual. That really means that guy is like, you know, flirtatious. As in a kotai, again, homosexual in NASB, means a male prostitute who served both heterosexual and homosexual clients. Therefore, Paul is proscribing, is against promiscuity and prostitution, not homosexuality. See where this is going? So the words were wrongly translated. Now, how do you respond to this? You are the devil. Shut up. We won't listen to you. Well, yeah, that's certainly a way. It makes feel good. And, you know, the amen corner says amen. But then if you want to be a credible testimony to the world, we probably skip that one. So I think there are two ways. Looking into the meaning given for these words in Greek lexicon produced by experts, not Boswell. He is an expert historian, but he's not expert in Greek words. I mean, just because I have a PhD in something doesn't mean I know about genetics or I know about, like, science like medicine. It doesn't carry over like that. You talk about Greek words, then let's go to Greek experts. Not you, buddy. And then another good one, and this is a good one for research for somebody. If I had to do another research project, I might do this because I'm interested in this. Looking into how these words were used in the literature of the antiquity. The words that were found in the Bible, they were used in other literatures. So I want to read those literatures and see how those words were define and use other literatures because of situations like this. Well, somebody already did that about this particular conflict. A response regarding malakoi. Definition found in the lexicon published by a reputable academic publisher. Reference books. I mean, isn't that why we have these kind of books? So according to a Greek-English lexicon of New Testament and other early Christian literature by University of Chicago Press, effeminate softens cloth. Okay. Person, soft, effeminate, especially a catamite. I still get up. A boy kept by pederast. You know, pederast is a man-boy relationship. So, akadama refers to the boy. And third, men and boys who allow themselves to be misused homosexually. Look, I will learn history from Boswell, but not Greek. This is what the Greek lexicon produced by Chicago University said. But then, more the merrier. So I looked at a Reader's Greek English Lexicon on the New Testament by Andrews University Press in England, and they said the same thing. Soft, effeminate, and catamite. I say, Dr. Boswell, you lose. Why should I listen to you? So, usage manacles in the literature of the antiquity. So somebody did the research. This is a good one. So, this person found out that in classical Greek, malakos was also applied to a man taking the female or passive role in homosexuality. Now, Lucian was a rhetorician in the 2nd century. I think he's from Syria originally. I looked it up. And he actually wrote a piece in condemning the blood of some priests who spend their time seeking group sexual encounters. So in condemning that, Lucian used the word malakos in reference to their passive homosexual behavior in a very belittling way. So, conclusion, while it could also mean weak or loose morally, it's not beyond reason to see the word representing the passive homosexual role, although also when it is used along with asenokotai, which 1 Corinthians 6:9 does. They are used consecutively. Malakos and asenokotai consecutively, according to research. So, this is not blowing hot air. There's a good scholarship behind why this word, malako, referred to men who take a passive role in homosexual relationship. About the word arsenikoites. It's a compound Greek word, arson. Now, not, you know, guys who like to start fire, but male with a strong emphasis on sex. When I heard that, it's probably the word macho. He's macho. Macho is a very sexually connoted word, you know. Koite means bed. Euphemism for sex. I mean, you know, we have the same thing, right? I don't want to mention it, but you turn bed into verb, it becomes, I had sex, right? So it's coarse word denoting licentious sexual activity. Romans 13:13. So I go back to those two lexicons, Chicago University. They had it like this. Male homosexual, again, pederast. And University lexicon, same thing. Male homosexual, sodomite. I mean, I don't know. What else are you going to do? Nah, I just trust Boswell. Why? I don't know. I just feel like it, you know. Come on, man. You want to be academic about this? Then let him teach history. This is territory for Greeks. So you learn from these guys. You don't tell them what they missed. That's how I would go about this. And then the Greek word, bias. You know, in 2002, Mark Tyler Connolly and Jeffrey Miner, pastors of pro-gay Metropolitan Community Church, argued in their book, The Children Are Free, Reexamining the Biblical Evidence for Same-Sex Relationships. They make a stunning argument. Remember this? When a Roman centurion came to Jesus and begged that he would come and heal his servant? That story? I never knew that he had a homosexual connotation. But there's a Greek word, bais. The Greek word bais that the Roman centurion used in reference to his sick servant whom he valued very highly while asking Jesus to heal him means beloved gay lover. Since Jesus commended the centurion for his great faith instead of condemning him, this would indicate that Christ approved his homosexuality. So, for my response, you can read my blog. Or, if I put appendix in my article, so you can read that when you get it at the end. What I'm skipping here, Hebrew word yada, other charges, this part very long. I'm going to skip all that so I can get you home before 12. No. But I will say this much. So I look, I did a bar, I did a research. So this word bais is used 24 times in the New Testament. Really, it's synonymous with doulas, you know, slave or servant. But there are about three or four times, and it's also used between God and the Father, God and Jesus' Son, the intimacy. I'm going to say something funny about that. But now, there are three or four instances where bais is used. If this is true, bais really has to mean gay lover. Read my blog. It means this. You know the prodigal son, right? It means that the elder son and the servant who spoke to him about the second son coming home, they were gay lovers because he was called bais. You know, Paul spoke for a very long time and this guy fell and died. What was his name? Eutychus? Yeah, Eutychus, right? Yeah, he died, right? Guess what? How he would refer? Bais. So that was Paul's gay lover, huh? I mean, so you can just, yeah, bias is used. If that's how you want to read the Bible, then just do that. But that is, to me, that's low. When the majority of the time is just synonymous for doulas. So you can read more about it in the text. Okay. I think that I haven't done all the studies that I have, but I think the Bible does not condemn it. I think that is also a disconnect. The final pillar is the wholesome image. It is so wholesome. This one is killer. I'm going to come back to this guy again. The same-sex marriage. The rationale. You know what the rationale is? Why are you against gay marriage? How would gay marriage affect your marriage? You know, you heard that, right? Why? How's it going to affect you? You know who said that first? The first gay congressman in the United States was that guy, Frank Barney. I heard that he was a pretty good politician from Boston. And in fact, he said many years ago, I don't understand how it hurts anybody else if two people want to be legally responsible for each other. You know, why are you getting into our business? Now, what his comment implies is simply this. Marriage as a private institution has no wider social consequences and therefore does not threaten the public good. In short, heterosexuals should not be concerned with something that will not affect them in the least. Don't worry. Don't worry. It won't affect you. They said that. Now, the second rationale for gay marriage, and this is a very important one. You know, when they framed gay marriage at first, it was the days of when a lot of gay men were dying of AIDS. It was a very tragic day. So many were dying of AIDS. And they were dying at a state where they were totally emaciated. It was a terrible scene. Even if you're not agreeing with their lifestyle, you had to feel bad for them. It was then that they started talking about marriage. In what context? Well, okay. Okay, another rationale. Okay, I'm going to come back later. Another rationale is that heterosexual marriage, you know, faithful gay relationship can actually enhance the institution of marriage itself because heterosexuals are not doing too well. So that'll show you how it's done. We are wholesome. So that one. Okay, now, this point is usually buttressed by stories of homosexual couples who were together for 20, 30 years without being allowed to be married. Like, that couple were together for 20, 30 years. When you look at that picture, yeah, humanly speaking, wow, you know, I'm not an animal. Like, I'm not going to say, well, how terrible they were together 30 years. I mean, you know, they were together for 30 years. But then they want to make this to be normative, that everybody's like this, when it's not. Now I'm going to come back to when gay marriage was first really seriously discussed. It was during the time of AIDS epidemic that was ravaging the gay community. Monogamous gay relationship was a key selling point for gay marriage. Read this. At the time, 1991. The AIDS plague and its staggering economic costs have so drastically affected our society that legal recognition of gay marriage should be explored. Assumption is that once they get married, they will stay what? Monogamous and faithful. Therefore, they won't have multiple partners, which was the reason why it was spreading through the gay community. First of all, they didn't know what was happening and they're now in protection. So let's get them married because they will be faithful. That's the picture they want to portray. Is that what happens in gay marriage? We have study out now that indicates that perhaps it is so, perhaps not. But that's important, is it not? Because that was the argument they brought up in the first place. Reality versus mirage. What the gay rights advocates don't want you to know. You know, LA Times, New York Times is still the best newspaper, well, most important newspaper in the United States. And they are very liberal, very left. But in 2010, they published an article that really infuriated gay rights advocates. Why did the same-sex marriage advocates got really upset at New York Times in 2010? It's because this newspaper reported a study that was done based out of San Francisco, and they had a gall to actually report it for people to read. A new study of gay couples in San Francisco shows that half are open, meaning that partners consent to each other having sex with other people. And that's not something that gay people want people to know. 2010 is not 2015. It's over now. But it wasn't over then. And they want to project this image that we are faithful. Learn from us. And yet, the real support, half were in open relationship. The result of the San Francisco survey shouldn't have been a shocker. You know why? Because there were other studies before that indicated the same thing. For example, Thomas Schmidt, he did a 10 random selected gay men, found the following in 1985. Out of 10, had a relationship lasting more than a year, 4. Having sex with other men while in a relationship, open, 6. Safe with the partner, 1. It was in-depth interview he did. It wasn't a survey. His conclusion, simply this. Promiscuity among homosexual men is neither a mere stereotype nor an experience of the majority of homosexuals. Basically, that's the only experience. Because as I read about this issue, it really isn't about sex. It is, but there's so much more going on when you have 2 or 3 partners a night. It has to be more than just sex. We'll go back to this article. The same-sex marriage advocate asked, how would gay marriage affect your marriage? New York Times. I'm borrowed their word, right? Gay union could significantly alter marriage norms. New York Times said this, the prevalence of such relationship could rewrite the definition traditional rule of matrimony by showing straight couples 2 things. Monogamy need not be a central feature of marriage. It does affect us. Sexually open relationship might point the way for the survival of the institution. All right, let's keep the institution, make it open, call it marriage, but we'll have just multiple partners. But that's not what the gays wanted us to know. But it wasn't the pastor who said it. It was New York Times who said it. So they were very upset. You know, the funny thing is, Sullivan now changes, right? So he even said gay male union could help strengthen and inform traditional marriage. Let us be open. What is most telling about the New York Times story is this. Nobody in an open relationship agreed to give their full name for the Times story, worrying that discussing the subject could undermine the legal fight for same-sex marriage. They knew what they were. Don't put my name. You know, cover my face, alter my voice, because I don't want you to, you know, write an article that would undermine our effort to make this legal. I mean, it's legal now, but not in 2010. Disinformation, folks. What the same-sex advocates really don't want you to know is how they really feel about the institution of marriage itself. Folks, they're not after marriage. They're after getting rid of it. You Christian pastor, always extremist. Not my words. Michael Kinsley was a big-time journalist for the left. New York Times, he once wrote for the richest guy in the world. What's the guy? Buffett. Bill Gates. Michael Kinsley, former columnist for New York and Washington Post, in speaking about the controversy of gay marriage, wrote this. 2003, he wrote this. The solution is to end the institution of marriage. Or rather, the solution is the end of the institution of government-sanctioned marriage or privatized marriage. What would it look like? Kinsley, let couples celebrate their union in any way they choose and consider themselves married whenever they want. And yes, if three people want to get married, or one person wants to marry herself, if someone else wants to conduct ceremony and declare them married, let them, big deal. If you and your government aren't implicated, what do you care? Redefine definition of marriage. You know, my wife said, honey, did you see this article? Did you see? Three Brazilian professional women just got married. Three got married together. And I read about this article. It's a means to an end, folks. And then Judith Stacy, New York professor, change the law to allow same-sex partner to marry would help supplant the destructive sanctity of the family. And it helped it assume varied, creative, and adaptive contour, including small group marriage. Yeah, maybe extreme voice of the academics, but we are going in that direction. And when you say, yeah, I'm for gay marriage, you are part and parcel to very diminishing of the marriage itself. Not a wishful thinking on their part, the data support their vision. Now, this is a very important part. You know, Europe is advanced even in this area. They had gay marriage before us. More than 25 years. We have hard data that have been collected now and analyzed. See, some European countries have long legalized gay marriage, as you know. And there are places, particularly in Scandinavian countries, where same-sex marriage is almost totally accepted. This is Stanley Kurt, PhD in social anthropology from Harvard. 2004, after reviewing all the available data regarding marriage trends in these countries, he raised this rhetorical question. Will same-sex marriage undermine the institution of marriage? Remember what the gay marriage advocates have predicted. They predicted the following. The same-sex marriage would strengthen the institution of marriage. So we buy into this. That's why we made it into a law now. We buy into this. What's not going to hurt us? You know, two people just doing their thing. No, none of our business. He said, will the same-sex marriage undermine the institution of marriage? His point, it already has. What are you talking about, putting into a future tense? For instance, he said, a majority of children in Sweden and Norway are born out of wedlock. Just like African, now I can talk without feeling like somebody's going to be racist. African Americans in the United States, over 70% of the babies are born out of wedlock, meaning unmarried couples. Over 70%. 60% of firstborn children in Denmark have unmarried parents. So what? So what? Instead of encouraging a society-wide return to marriage, Scandinavian gay marriage has driven home the message that marriage itself is outdated, and that virtually in any family form, including out of wedlock, parenthood, is acceptable. See, heterosexual, of course, get affected. I mean, look, do heterosexuals get married these days as before? They're not getting married anyway. You know, the question is this. The ultimate consequence, more children living in single-parent homes. How will that result in something negative? Partners in coupling, quote, cohabiting without marriage would find it easier to leave a difficult or stagnant relationship than married couples, right? Why do boyfriends and girlfriends break off a lot easier than married people? For, you know, obvious reason, they did not sign the dotted line. Long-term repercussions of children raised in single-parent home. Today, the empirical evidence is undeniable that family breakdown feeds a host of social pathologies. It is the single most reliable predictor of school problems, teenage pregnancy, chemical addictions, and crime. 70% of long-term prison inmates grew up in a fatherless home, as did 60% of rapists and 72% of adult murderers. That's for a single-parent home. And you know how they're going to shut me up? Well, Bill Clinton, the president, was part of a single home. There are a lot of great exceptions. And that's why we, okay, yeah, right. No, on the general average, this is the result. This is not a good situation. And I'm related to gay marriage. It affects the heterosexual marriage. A necessary reiteration, the ultimate concern of the same-sex gay advocate, abolishing the institution of marriage. Their method, appealing to justice and fairness in making pitch for same-sex marriage. Like a black civil rights, which has nothing to do with the right to get married. Saying things like, it's not fair, it's plain unjust. Thus, no one should be surprised by this development in parts of Europe where same-sex has long been permitted. You know what percentage of gays actually get married in places where same-sex marriage has been in the law book for a long time? I was shocked. Data from countries with same-sex marriage show approximately 96% of them don't get married when given the opportunity. I mean, yeah, that makes sense. This marriage thing is just a statement-making. Why would they want to get married? I mean, look at heterosexual. Do they get married? I mean, why would homosexual want to get tied down, you know? But it's a statement-making. For now, they get married. For later, hey, forget it. 96% don't get married. What this shows, the same-sex marriage is an effective means to punt or marginalize the institution of marriage. And I say to you that any Christian who says, I'm against homosexuality, but I'm for gay marriage, you are actually aiding and abetting the process. That which no one mentions. And this one, you know, I want you to include this in a dialogue with others. I try to talk to people. I was going to New York in a bus. And I sent to this guy. And so I wanted to strike a conversation with him. So, you know, I found out he's a therapist, right? He's a young man, therapist. So I said, oh, you and I are in the same profession. He says, are you a therapist yourself? Oh, no, I'm a pastor. I try to help people. And, you know, and then he says, no, you're not. You judge. He did with a smile. You know what I attempt to say? What do you call what you're doing to me right now? You're judging me. But then, you see, end of conversation, we still have an hour and a half to go. I didn't choose that option. Yeah. And you know, this is what happened. I said to him, and then we talked about, sex. We talked about sex for a while, and he gave, I shut him up. Whatever he said, I was going to shut him up. And then he said, what about homosexuality? He didn't want to go down quietly. What about homosexuality? He thought he had me. What I'm going to tell you right now is how he was shut up again. I did not quote scriptures. You know, this has to matter in your conversation with others. I hope it does. I hope you study this, make it into part of vocabulary, and do it with smile. I kept my smile. I did not go, I smiled. You know, and then, you know, I could be jovial. Like, I could, like, do a little, hey, come on, that's good. I, you know, just make it light. But the points were very heavy. I said, you guys won, man. Congratulations. It's over. You know, I'm not here. Don't beat the dead horse, you know. I just ask you a couple of things. That's all. And I told him this. Tell them the whole thing. If they are curious to find out what this is, don't you think they should know all the facts to make wise choice? And then I shared some of these data, as I recall, in the bus ride. Homosexual lifestyle is hazardous to the long-term health of gays. What one study found, it leads to a 5 to 10 year decrease in life expectancy. From the book written by MIT Harvard psychiatrist, I had worse numbers, but he was not as credentialed, so I'm not using it, but that's even worse numbers. I want you to tell them that it will shorten your life. Two, what a recent controversial study said, oh, I guess I do have it, a median age of death for male homosexuals is in their 40s and lesbians in their 50s. But it is very controversial, so I'm just letting it out there. Okay. According to the Center for Disease Control, gay and bisexual men account for the vast majority of syphilis cases, more than 60% in 2005. And that's what the bone will look like if you have syphilis. It's a terrifying disease. I'm just saying, just tell them. A warning label is in the same way that we expect the producers of cigarettes and alcoholic beverage to warn the consumers of their potential health threats, the gay rights movement should not be held to any lesser standard. And that's what I told him. Just tell him the whole thing, would you? I mean, isn't it fair that these are facts? So I'm smiling. Yeah, come on, man. Tell the whole thing. What are you afraid of? You know, it's a good thing, right? So tell them that you can shorten their life and cause more disease. Why do you want to hide those facts? Antidotes is very, very good. I haven't told any story, right? I'll tell you one story, powerful story. I shut him up because of this. It's the Holy Spirit. You know, Holy Spirit reminds you, right? There's a dermatologist who serves, who goes to one of our MI churches. She's serving at Manhattan. We went to Guatemala together, I mean other people together, and then, you know, when I was talking, she told me about her practice. Manhattan, New York. There are a lot of gays. A lot of gay men come to her and they want her to treat her. So they have, you know, an infection of skin. She would examine them. Often she has to tell them that I cannot help you because this is not skin disease. This is an infection. And then she would ask, can you tell me about your sex life? And she says, I'm not going to talk to you about my sex life. Just give me something to alleviate the pain. I don't want to talk about it. They don't want to talk about it. You understand? So I told him with a smile, I mean, don't you think if guys comes up with skin irritation, find an infection, shouldn't he talk about it and get something to cure the infection? But he doesn't want to talk about it. He just wants something to cure his symptom. I mean, is that okay? You know, is that okay? Yeah, what's he going to do? Yeah, that's okay. Well, I mean, you know, he doesn't have anything to say. Nothing. Smile. I didn't quote any scriptures. And then at the end, he said, well, you know, you already knew, right? God made us man and woman. And that is a normative institution. You knew that. That you don't agree with. But that's the original game plan. That's the blueprint. He was embarrassed. He couldn't have a comeback. Now, I'm not here to tell you that I won. Ultimately, I said as we were departing, with a smile, hey, believe Jesus Christ and have eternal life and be a better therapist. You know what he did? Thank you. It was fun. It has to be a different angle that you have to get in. You cannot go in as before. They're going to label you. You're a judger. That's what he was looking for. If I quote a scripture right there and there, I see you judge. That's what he told me I judge. I did not judge. But I did judge at the end. It is wholesome game. It is wholesome. It's not wholesome. Okay, final point. Theological importance of the institution marriage. As Bible-believing Christians and students of social science, we should not treat the institution marriage as if it were a human convention. It certainly is not. You know, social science really helps out here. Tom Bottomore, you know, big-time sociologist from England, in his book, textbook, marriage and family were supposed to have evolved from primitive promiscuity through various forms of plural marriage to monogamy, you know, simple to complex evolutionary paradigm. They applied to everything. And that's what we thought. But this eminent sociologist. But in more recent work, the evolutionary approach has been abandoned. It just doesn't fit. The data we have doesn't fit our theory. It's been abandoned. So do you have any idea how it got started? No, not really. They don't know, but they know what it's not. It's not evolutionary paradigm. Promiscuity, could, you know, living, and then plural marriage and monogamy. No, it wasn't. It was monogamy from the get-go, and then we deviated. The belief in a single line of development has had to be given up in the face of anthropological evidence, and it has even proved difficult to find any general framework of explanation to account for any of the things that we have. Did you see what I just said? Social science is waking up that we don't know what is not, we don't know what is, we don't know because they don't want to say it's God. No single line of development here. The scripture is not silent on that which perplexes social science. You know it, right? Genesis 1:27. God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female. You know, he created them. In the very beginning, it was a monogamous relationship between a man and a woman. And then we deviated. You know how quickly it became plural marriage? In chapter 4, Lamech had two wives. It only took 3 chapters. I mean, you know what it was? This is called sin, when you deviate from God's plan. You know, do not focus on homosexuality. It is all sin. Adultery, premarital sex, surrender. God can forgive. It's not saying that. Ever since then, the institution of marriage has done not so well at all. We have not done well. Homosexuals are right. We have not done well. Christian marriage are at risk. Many are getting divorced. I heard rate as high as 30 or 40%. No one is saying heterosexuals are better than those who have homosexual desires or find themselves in homosexual relations. Are you kidding? But apart from Christ, we are all hopeless sinners. And it is the marital bond between man and a woman which the Holy Scripture, Holy Spirit, uses to tell us just how much Christ loves and cares for his church. Ephesians 5:25, 31-32, husband and wife, just as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her, for this reason a man will leave his mother and father and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. This is a profound mystery, but I'm talking about Christ and the church. You see, the marital bond between a man and a woman was part of the redemptive plan of the Lord. It was not a human convention, but an integral part of God's original blueprint for humankind, not only to procreate, to have a wonderful life here on earth under two parents, but also part of redemptive analogy. Ephesians 5, Jesus Christ just did not go, oh, what would be a cool illustration? Oh, yeah, Mary. No, no. He was already there for that purpose. So, practical. I'm going fast now because I want to get you out pretty soon. Practical recommendation. For a better Christian witness in the midst of dealing with homosexuality, for an alternative to same-sex marriage, to help those gays who want to leave their lifestyle. Okay. A, what Christians should oppose. I oppose any law that would make homosexuality illegal or criminal. Why? Because we no longer live in theocracy, but in democracy, in which every individual has been accorded with certain constitutional rights. I'm not too sure what specific right should be applied here. I'm guessing somewhere between freedom of association and private act. So if they want to be homosexual, I don't want them penalized. I don't want them to be put in prison. I'm against all that. Tell your friends that. They think that you are like find a big stone and stone them or something. And they have said things like that based on Old Testament, which I didn't cover, but you can read it in the document. No, I'm against that. Furthermore, we ought to defend them if some haters verbally abuse or physically harm homosexuals. I will run. And we should defend the guy who's getting beaten. And the guy might say, oh, you homosexual advocate, are you? No, I'm not. But no one bearing the likeness of God should be treated that way. And you bear that image before anything else. So I'm going to do my best to defend you. You know what? I haven't tested of this, but why can't media tell the world that they're not a Christian who feels the same way, instead of projecting us as, you know, evil, blood-sucking, hateful? There are some, but they don't represent me. A lot of us are like this. I told that young man in the bus, I said this. He never heard this before. He liked it. He kind of neutralized his venom somewhat. Effective treatments? Oh, what? That's anathema. That's enough for someone to say, you're homophobic. Treatment, there's no need for treatment, right? You know, that guy I just talked about, Jeffrey Santanova, he devoted 31 pages of documents, medical journal articles that chronicled so many different ways that gays actually have turned against their gay lifestyle and became heterosexuals. I was shocked. It was called the best book on homosexuality written on our time, Congressional Report. This book cannot be written today. No publisher will publish this book. You write this book, your career is shot. He's now astrophysicist. He gave up that practice. When I found out, I go, oh, it must be nice to be smart, first of all. And it's like, he's a Christian now, and he saw the writing on the wall that it's over. But there are 31 pages of treatment that you talked about. Gay rights advocates shouldn't categorically reject any attempt to help those gays who sincerely want changes. That is, Sullivan's remark cuts both ways. He said this, homosexuality exists. That is involuntary for a proportion of society, that for a few more, it is an option. And then he said, and that it need not be discouraged. Okay? Cut both ways. And that it not be encouraged due to its health risk, including a shorter lifespan. In fact, just give them the facts and let them choose. I will stress the risk involved. And then when he kind of listened, I'll throw in the moral imperative. By the way, it's not God's will. God didn't design it that way. But I have the urge, you know. Important distinction. What the gay rights advocate love to point out, treatments don't work because they cannot completely get rid of homosexual desires. I have a confession to make. I'm faithfully married to my wife. I love my wife. And I mean, it's not like I think about this, but do you think that I have no desire whatsoever of committing adultery? Like 0%? I pitch you every now and then. Thought come through. I mean, I'm getting in trouble now, but I mean, if I told you that I never thought about this, like even fleeting moment, would you believe me? You cannot ever get rid of desire 100%. There's no such a thing. If you're alcoholic and you're not drinking anymore, oh, you have no desire to drink, huh? Are you kidding? Yes, it's true. But through treatment and ministry, homosexual desire may be diminished, but they won't go away completely. Even sinful natures in Ghana are completely diminished. We're not talking about complete getting rid of it. That should not surprise us at all. We all live with many unwanted desires. An alcoholic wanting a drink, a husband or wife desiring to have an affair, and they did, Ashley Madison. But that doesn't mean we must give them, you know, we must give in to them. While more needs to be said on this matter with sensitivity, the principle itself is very clear. Having a particular desire doesn't mean that, yes, obey your thirst, but I could drink water instead of Sprite. Yes, I did obey the thirst. Having a particular desire doesn't mean that we have the right to give in to it. Being in the right environment is the key. Come on, that's for everything. I mean, that you have that urge, you can meet the urge by doing something else. There's a short term and long term. Long story short, yes, desire may be there, diminished, but nonetheless is there. But a right, wrong day, wrong time, wrong people, wrong scene. Yeah, I could see them relapse. That doesn't mean it failed. It just means that we are frail humans. Some people drink again. Some people go back to homosexuality for a day or two or maybe even longer. That doesn't mean it failed. Like any attempt to break loose from strongholds in our life, several necessary conditions need to be met. Having a sincere faith in God, confession of sin, contrition, and repentance. Developing spiritual discipline, consistent prayer life, and studying of God's word. Come on, folks. You cannot beat this thing unless you have a consistent prayer life. You know, it's not my first thing I do in the morning, I pray. At least an hour. Every day. I just have it. I hope it's not recorded. Because it's a really crude example, but I should not say this, but you know, it's like go to bathroom and not wiping yourself, like that icky feeling. Yeah, it's like that. I gotta pray. Otherwise, I have an icky feeling. That's good. And also running. I run consistently. I ran today, yesterday. So good happens to have. And I read the Bible every single day. Every single day. Well, I skip here and there, you know, every 6-7 months. But, you know, you got to have this. Without it, you cannot deal with the desire. Because, you know what? I just noticed that. I was in Turkey for 7 days. I did not turn on TV even once. Legalist. No, I'm not. I was too busy preparing and praying. I haven't turned that TV on even once. I just noticed that. Before I would, not because to watch something bad, but just I'm too busy. And I go, I guess I changed. I'm not trying to be legalist. I just noticed that I haven't turned TV even once. It's okay to watch TV, okay? As long as it's a good thing. I'm just saying that we could create an environment where sinning is less possible. And if you do, it's less in depth and intensity. And that's what I'm trying to say. And also, belonging to a community of people who love us and to whom we can be held accountable is, I think, very critical. Yeah. Sin? Yes. Repentance toward Christ. Discipleship in a new community. And finally, service, especially helping those who struggle with the same thing we battle. I think that's a winning combination for anything, including homosexuality. Look, I'm not an expert in terms of just experience, but I've done the research, and I just want to inform you. I think your church, Hip Church, I hope that your church have a wonderful ministry with people with these tendencies and maybe living that lifestyle. And somehow they can come and realizing that you're not agreeing with them, but then they can come and be friends and slowly but surely through relationship, they get to see that the need that they were trying to meet through almost a relationship is met through this, so that they don't have to have that kind of stuff. Some people are really strongly urged, so we go after low-hanging fruits, meaning those who are kind of curious, kind of like exploring stage. I would target them first instead of those who are full-on gays at this point in time. And with your hip pastor here, do it. Hope that this long talk will bear some fruit. And that's my prayer. And Pastor, you want to wrap it up? I'm done finally. I'm so happy.